this week's show, our thoughts on the USA's return to action after a 9-month hiatus, details about My Cujo streaming sites being sold, Champions League TV ratings keep on going up and up, more thoughts on the European Super League, plus we have letters from you, the listeners, in our mailbag section. I'm Christopher Harris, a.k.a. The Gaffer, joined alongside my co-host, Kartik Krishnayar. If you're new to this podcast, we're your weekly guide to getting the best out of soccer viewing options from around the world. And speaking of, Kartik, around the world, we're now in the international break, in quotation marks, and lots of games coming up, lots of games being played today, Thursday, as we're recording this. We'll get into the US in a little bit, but Scotland have qualified for a major tournament, the first time in 22 years. The last time Scotland were in a major tournament, which was the 98 World Cup, do you remember who managed them?
In 1998, was it Craig Brown?
Was it? Or was it Sir Alex Ferguson? No, you're right. It was Craig Brown. I'm thinking that in 1986 World Cup.
86, it was when Jock Steen passed. And Sir
That's
Alex
right.
took over. Jock Steen died of a heart attack during the qualifier against Wales, right? The do-or-die qualifier, Wales. And you think about that Welsh era. That was when Ian Rush played. That's when you had so many really great Welsh players.
Yeah, Mark Hughes. It's been so long that since Scotland have qualified for a major tournament that I got the wrong tournament in mind. It's been that long. But 98 with Craig Brown. Yeah, that's right. So, I mean.
And then Northern Ireland, for the second straight major tournament, has fallen short in the playoffs. So that's. It could have been all four home nations. Northern Ireland obviously qualified in 16 and made the knockout stages, but they fall just short, but great for Scotland.
Absolutely. So before we get to talking about the friendly between Wales and the US, I don't want to go into a lot of depth about last week's matches in terms of the Premier League. And I mean, it's great to see Leicester and Spurs at the top of the table and Southampton in fourth place. A lot of positives there. Of course, a lot of controversial VAR calls, which are just, really, really holding the game back in terms of the way that the rules are set up currently. Those have to change soon. What about you, Kartik? Was there anything from this past weekend before the international break you want to mention before we go into talking international matches?
Yeah, two things. One, I don't understand why England can't get VAR right, because I watch, as everyone knows, a fair amount of Serie A and a fair amount of Bundesliga. I used to watch a fair amount of MLS. I haven't watched a single minute of MLS since the final in the Disney tournament between Orlando and Portland. But those leagues don't have these problems. There may be one or two calls every now and then that are problematic, but I don't know. I don't think they're ever going to get it right in the Premier League. And we know they're not going to scrap it, but I think the overwhelming sentiment from supporters I talk to is they want it gone. They'd rather have the mistakes and the controversies of the past than the way it is now. So, that's my VAR talking point for the week. My other talking point is I had all kinds of problems, again, with Peacock. I did not realize you cannot mirror Peacock from an iPad or an iPhone to an Apple TV. Now you can mirror the sound, but you can't mirror the actual video.
Right.
And then Peacock on my device on the TV wasn't working properly because it was working, but it was at a lower bandwidth, so I couldn't watch the game properly because it wasn't streaming in HD. This may not be Peacock's fault, actually, or NBC's fault. This was right in the middle of ETA. That Liverpool-Manchester City game was right in the middle of ETA. But I was kind of shocked I couldn't then – when I was able to get the right resolution on my phone at first and then on my iPad when the phone didn't work to mirror, that I wasn't able to mirror to the Apple TV from that. So that's some sort of lock within the Peacock app, I think, on iOS to be aware of. So I actually did not watch Liverpool and Manchester City and just ended up watching the Bundesliga and Serie A for the rest of Sunday on ESPN Plus. And again, we were in the middle of a tropical storm, which was quite frankly, and Chris, you've just gone through it. It's just cleared your area 5 days later after what I'm talking about, what happened here 4 days later. But this, I think most people would agree that this tropical storm In South Florida was actually worse than most of the hurricanes we've had. Just the amount of rain, the amount of wind, the duration of the event. So I'm not going to hold that against Peacock. I just do think that there's some sort of issue with Apple and the mirroring from devices that may need to be fixed.
Yeah, so let's talk about the Peacock a little bit later. I've got a couple of tips on that one, a couple of questions, actually. We'll probably cover that more in the listener mailbag. But going to the Wales USA game and watching it, this is actually the first international match involving the US men's national team that's been on Fox or FS1 in almost exactly a year. That was the last time a game was on television on FS1 for the US men's national team, which was a game against Cuba that they won 4-0. A lot has changed in the last 12 months. Regarding the coverage itself, it was pretty much a really kind of a no-frills, low-budget, Rob Stone and Alexi Lalas in the studio, Stu Holden, John Strong doing the commentary. Commentary was fine. The analysis was okay. But they really didn't put much of an effort into this one. We've got FS1 that has the game next week too, which is the US against Panama on Monday. Same channels, FS1, Tuduene, and Unimas, I believe, on that one. But how did you watch the game, Kartik? What was your viewing choice this time?
Yeah, so I did actually watch the game on FS1. I haven't in the past. For most of the last 3 years, if a match is on FS1, I've chosen to watch it on 2DNA. I thought John Strong and Stuart Holden were pretty good today, actually, considering they were in separate studios. I liked Holden's crack about what Gareth Bale must have been watching on his Mac, right? I think he's right. He probably was watching the Masters. We know Bale's affinity for golf. So I thought the analysis was pretty good, given this is a set of players we haven't really seen in play together with the U.S. I do think one point I would have made if I were Lawless or Holden, but wasn't made, was that I think Serginho Dest is so comfortable in the system because it's the system he grew up in at Ajax. So he doesn't, even though he hasn't played very much for the U.S., right, compared to some of the other guys in that team, he knows exactly what's expected of him because it's a very Dutch setup. But I thought it was fine. Stone and Lawless were very kind of no frills. It was low budget. It was okay. And I will admit I did not watch the post game because I was watching Northern Ireland, and Slovakia and Scotland and Serbia. Yeah. Right. So, I don't know how they were in the post game, but I do think that FS1 we're seeing in their coverage just really kind of cheap, low budget. I got more pregame out of Taylor Twellman. So Taylor Twellman was obviously calling the Scotland Serbia match, but he also came on with Kay Murray before that match to talk a little bit about the U.S. I got a little more out of him and what Berhalter was thinking and et cetera. He had just spoken to Berhalter a day or two ago than I did out of the Fox pregame show. And again, it wasn't that Fox had a terrible pregame show. It was just, you know, they had a feature and then they, you know, kind of had a lot of commercials and that was it.
Yeah.
And then went to Holden and Strong, who I said had a pretty good game, but they're limited by the production. I mean, that's the reality. You know, the talent can only look so good. This is important for our listeners to remember. The talent can only look so good if the production level and the commitment from the broadcaster is low. So, yeah, I mean, maybe people will critique Stu Holden and John Strong, but I give them a pass if there were shortcomings, which I didn't really notice, if I'm honest with you.
Yeah, I mean, ESPN obviously not having the rights to this game, but putting more of an effort into it in many ways. I mean, they had the broadcast of Georgia against North Macedonia that kicked off at noon Eastern time. That game was over on ESPN2 at 2 p.m. Eastern, which I was expecting them to then take a break for half an hour and go to, I mean, I don't know, Sports Center or some of the programming. But they stayed on the air from 2 o'clock all the way through till 2:45, doing some analysis of the Euro 2020 playoff games, as well as talking about the U.S. men's national team. Kay Murray hosting, Taylor Twellman there. I mean, really, to me, Taylor Twellman would be a much better fit at Fox Sports if Fox was willing to put in more of an effort, and maybe they will for the next World Cup. And they got the 2026 World Cup too. So maybe in the future, Taylor Twellman, maybe if there's a deal to be worked out there, there's an opportunity for him to go to that side. I think he'd fit in there and actually benefit them much greater than he is at ESPN, which ESPN is doing fine too.
At the same time, I don't think that he wants to go to a network that doesn't have the Bundesliga and doesn't have the it would have been much more enticing to him when they still had the Bundesliga rights and when they were showing more European qualifiers.
But the World Cup, though. I mean, imagine.
Oh, well, that's true. That's true.
2026 World Cup and Gold Cup. And, I mean, in terms of that, his audience is mostly fans of U.S. soccer and Major League Soccer. I mean, you look at his Twitter account, he's all the time MLS, 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 very little on the Bundesliga.
Yeah, that might be true because that's his audience, but I think he kind of geeks out, if I'm honest with you. Whatever he calls these games, I mean, the Heman Champion, again, they were at a – especially given kind of the dour circumstance in Belgrade. It didn't have the atmosphere. Normally it would have been rocking, right, if it wasn't for COVID. That's a cauldron to go into. Scotland really called a break with COVID.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
I'm honest with you because that's not a place you go in and win a match.
There would have been fireworks. Honestly. There would have been bottles. There would have been riot police. I mean, it would have been intense.
It's a horrible place to go.
Yeah.
But they were able to keep me interested in their match with their call. And Twellman has all these random things he knows about the players. I mean, I think his prep is outstanding. Now, obviously, some of the Scottish guys like McTominay and Robertson and Tierney, Twellman would know a lot about anyway because they play for big English clubs. But he knew a lot about the other guys on Scotland too, which impressed me.
But that's the thing, though, too. I think, and actually we didn't mention it until now, is De Clasica. So that was last weekend, obviously, on ESPN Plus. Taylor Twellman and Derek Ray doing the commentary. Derek Ray, exceptional as always. Taylor in this game, a couple of times, actually was kind of speaking and talking so much that he almost talked into a couple of goals. Attacks were happening, and Derek said, "Hey, stop. Let me call this out." So I think that's the thing about Taylor sometimes, is that some games I think MLS is back. There were some games he was so quiet. Other times lately, he's been a little bit too talkative.
I think you're right. That Dortmund Bayern game, there was a lot going on. Right?
It was,
It was a really good match.
Yeah.
But he was talking more than he usually does. That's a great point.
We'll get back to the US against Wales in a second, but I do want to mention with the Clásica, and it was a great game, great coverage. I mean, you had Dan Thomas pre-match, and I think Craig Burley and. My only concern about this, Kartik, and you're probably part of the same crowd too, is that every year the hopes get up. And we all talk about, okay, Dortmund's going to do great. And yes, they did well in this game. Yes, it was close. And yes, if they had taken their chances, they could have maybe tied or won this game. But pre-match, they went around and asked the pundits there and said it in the ESPN studio, who do you think is going to win this game? You mean, is it going to be Bayern or is it going to be Dortmund? Craig Burley said that it'd be Dortmund. Steve Cherundolo said it'd be Dortmund. Klinsmann predicted a draw. Kind of be a little bit kind of political there, maybe perhaps. But not one person predicted that Bayern was going to win this game. And yes, we all want Borussia Dortmund to win these games, just to add some competitiveness. But Bayern always seems to eke out a win, no matter what.
Yeah, so we've had three times they've played since the restart, right? They played right after the restart, which is a match that effectively decided the title. And then the Super Cup just a few weeks ago, and then this match. And they've all kind of followed the same script. Dortmund have had better chances. They've had more chances, particularly that Super Cup match. I mean, the Bayern goal that won the match came completely against the run of play when Dortmund were bossing the match. And then this match was the same thing. I have to say, it was a huge buzzkill that match because Dortmund were creating better chances. It looked like they were organized. It looked like Favre had the shape good, and they snatched at the chances. And I thought conceded a few cheap goals, considering everything. The pre match though was quite good, which Rundelo and Klinsmann and Burley. But they all. they're trying to build up Dortmund. And I will tell you, I'm not only part of that crowd, Chris. Some people would allege, if you watch my Twitter, I'm the leader of that crowd. Because I, you know, every I fall into it every season. After a couple matches in the season, I'll say, this is the year Dortmund's going to win the title. I did it again this year. I did it again after Dortmund beat, was it Mönchengladbach or Schalke early on? I said, okay, this team's better than Bayern this season. Bayern is going to be so concerned about winning in Europe that Dortmund, all these young players, they have the energy, they're going to have the fitness, they're going to beat them. But then, of course, if you're going to beat them to the title, you're going to at least have to get a draw at home when you play them in the league. And it was the same thing last season. I said it, and then the year before, I was almost right. Remember, it came down to the last day of the season, but still Dortmund didn't make it. And I'm also the guy who always on Twitter is making the excuse about Marco Reus, saying, oh, well, it's if he were fit, Dortmund would have won the league if he had played 32 games instead of 25 matches. But I think it's three or four straight years I've fallen into that trap. So, and by the way, people who are friends of mine do kid me about it. That, you know, they'll see me put the tweet up about Dortmund is going to beat Bayern this year, and I get a bunch of DMs. Oh, don't be doing that again. Is it just your shtick now, or do you really believe it? So, yeah, I fall into that, and I think the ESPN pundits did the same thing because we so badly want it, right? And we love the fact that Dortmund brings these young players through, and we love the way they play and the atmosphere around that club. But it's just there's something mentally there that they can't get over the hump. I mean, I think it's mental now.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it, though, too, really is Bayern Munich in terms of just how much of a powerhouse they continue to be. I mean, it's just an incredible team, and these players are playing at such a high level. Now, speaking, going back to the Wales against US friendly, which I promised to do, first of all, it was really, really good to see the US play a game again. This is the first time they've played since February 1st, when they had really kind of a nothing friendly against Costa Rica. And like I said, too, it's been almost a year to the day since their last competitive match against Cuba. So it's been a long time since they've been challenged at kind of a really, really high level. I don't think this game was it either. But some of the positives I got out of this game in terms of the US were better possession. They played much, much better, especially in that first half as far as keeping the ball, being a lot more energetic, being a little bit definitely more attractive to the eye to watch. And also it was good to see some of these up-and-coming players having a chance to finally get some playing time playing together for the US men's national team. What about you, Kartik? What were some of the positives you saw from this game?
From the team, I mean, I think Dest, as I mentioned a little earlier, fits beautifully into Berhalter's system. He's grown up in that system at Ajax. John Brooks is phenomenal on the ball, can pick a pass, can really start. If you're going to build from the back, that's a perfect guy to have as a ball-playing center half. And I know Rafa Honigstein had said years ago that he was kind of a Jerome Boateng level ball-playing center back, maybe not necessarily the same level as a defender, but as a ball-playing center half coming up at the time in Hertha Berlin. He's had a lot of injuries, but we see how much better the U.S. are when he plays. Obviously, some young players that look good. Weston McKennie looked good for sure. Conrad De La Fuente looked kind of lively and interesting. Now, Moussa looked very good. A lot of talk about him, but I do want to remind the listeners that he has played every match of his youth career. Now, he's got a senior cap for the U.S., but every match of his youth career for England, and I am sure he is on the radar for Gareth Southgate. He'll have to make a decision, right? Because where he plays, there are a lot of guys who are going to be playing for many, many years ahead of him in the England team. For the U.S., it looks like maybe he can move right into the first team. He certainly showed he could today. Mm-hmm. So don't count on that kid playing for the U.S. I think he probably leans towards England anyway because it's England.
Yeah, speaking of Yusuf, I watched him play this past weekend in what was my match of the weekend, which was Valencia against Real Madrid, a 4-1 victory. He scored a goal which was chalked off for, I think, offside, and then also involved in a play that earned a penalty. And it looked really, really promising. So, I mean, hopefully Greg Berhalter and his team will encourage him to go ahead and get that, because the friendly wouldn't count. But in terms of earning, actually playing for the U.S. men's national team and committing to the U.S. men's national team. But my issue with this, Kartik, is that I think a lot of people are probably very excited about the US performance. For me, I have to take it with a grain of salt, because this is definitely not a first-string Wales team. Having been born in Wales, I'm half Welsh, half American, having watched this team for a long time, this was a team that, out of the starting lineup of 11 players, there was not one player on this team that actually plays for a Premier League club, other than the goalkeeper, Danny Ward, who is a third-string goalkeeper at Leicester City and has had zero appearances in the Premier League. So this was mostly a team of Football League players, some Championship players, mostly Championship players. But you even had, in the second half, some of the subs coming on as appearances. You had a player that plays for Newport County in League 2. And then you had a player that plays for Lincoln City in League 1. This is definitely not the Wales team that we will see in the Euro 2020 with Gareth Bale, Ben Davis, Joe Roden.
Yeah. Oh, sorry to cut you off.
No. But
in a couple of days in the Nations League.
Right.
Okay. Let's be honest about that. And I didn't want to sound too negative, so I didn't want to say that. But so thankfully you are. Continue.
Yeah. But I mean, the US of course missing Christian Pulisic due to injury. So it wasn't a. This was not a second string Wales team. There's probably about 2 to 3 players that started in this game that would normally play for Wales probably in the next few days in the UEFA Nations League, starting those games. So that's kind of the level that they're at. So with the US, I mean, Alexi Lalas talking about the performances, saying that, I mean, 6 out of 10. Kartik Krishna are saying maybe 6 or 7 out of 10. To me, I don't think those numbers. I mean, yes, if it's against an extremely high-level team, and you can only play against who you're playing against, right, the 11 players that are in front of you. But I think we have to rein in some of this hype. Well, the hype is okay, but I think we need to realize that this US team has a long way to go before they get to a level of really competitiveness.
Yeah, I don't know if the hype is okay, actually, Chris, because this is the same trap we keep falling into with the U.S., where players get overhyped, they get too much pressure on them, then they don't play well, or they fall out of favor at the club level, and the U.S. fans are look, I mean, every national team, every club team has bad fans. They're bad Spurs fans, they're bad Juventus fans, they're bad Bayern Munich fans. But I don't think that there's a collective set of fans I think are as deluded, in my experience, as U.S. men's national team fans. So this, I do think it is a problem, because we're going to start this vicious cycle again. And then when a player performs poorly, that player is going to get ripped to pieces. These are kids. You're right. They were playing against the watered-down Wales squad. The fan base, still the way they handle the talking about Josie Altidore and Michael Bradley. I mean, I can't trust this fan base to make sound – reasoned judgments about players. So now everybody, I saw tweets today talking about how, oh, this one's better than Bradley ever was. That one is better than Chirundolo ever was. Like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
I mean, this is madness. So it's a fan base that's desperate, that doesn't necessarily, isn't really seasoned sometimes in their analysis. So it's important the media that covers the national team keep them grounded. I don't know if they're going to do that or not do that.
I don't think so. I mean,
yeah, here we go again then.
Yeah, the potential is here with these players. I mean, these players are getting earning some really valuable Champions League experience with, I mean, RB Leipzig, Barcelona. I mean, you go down the list. There's a lot of players, Juventus, a lot of players on this squad that could, as far as the team chemistry, playing together, and Giorena, of course, with Dortmund, but playing at a high level and improving as a team, and they're still young, and there's a lot of potential here. But I think you in terms of you saying, okay, they need to kind of be more grounded, especially the U.S. soccer media, 100%. I mean, because I don't think is going to happen, though, Kartik. The hype is
work out. I mean, Serbia. I looked at the front three for the pre-match. You know, I'm rooting for Scotland, and I'm excited about potential of Scotland making a tournament for the first time in 22 years. And I love Steve Clark. Those who know me know that I have kind of a fetish for him as a manager, and feel like he's gotten the short end of the stick wherever he's been. But I see the front three for Serbia. I'm like, my goodness, this is going to be really one-way traffic. Sometimes, and it wasn't, right? Serbia were terrible until the 89th minute. Sometimes the clubs guys play at and the level they play at those clubs don't translate to international football. And the U.S. historically has had guys who played better for the national team than they did at the club level. And there could be a reversal of that because, like I saw and I mentioned on the other show I was on tonight, Lyonnais came into this match and played really well for me for 20 minutes. And he really got stuck in, did some nice things. He's a guy who's he's hardly even playing at the club level. And sometimes it doesn't translate. So there's this assumption among U.S. men's national team fans that, oh, we have all these guys playing in the Champions League, so we're going to be fantastic. Well, the truth be told, there are countries that have guys playing at that same level who don't even qualify for major tournaments. I mean, think about the last time Norway qualified for a major tournament. They've had guys, they've had global superstars, Haaland now, Solskjaer in the past, any number of other guys. Right. So it's not as simple as it looks. And I think that's another thing. The media is kind of feeding this thing. Oh, well, this guy's playing at Barcelona. That guy's playing at Juventus. This guy's playing at Chelsea. That one's playing at Dortmund. We're going to be great. Well, it doesn't always work that way.
Well, that's the thing about the hype, though, too, is that and CBS Sports is guilty of this, too, Kartik. It's not just Fox Sports, but it's one of the things that if you do talk about the Christian Pulisic, NBC Sports hyping it up big time, right? All these players are playing at a high level, playing at top clubs, doing wonders, doing really well, with showing a lot of promise. And the media buys into it because they know that if the media buys into it, then the fans get excited. And the fans get, buying tickets, buying merchandise. They get excited on social media versus the reality, say, 6 months ago or a year ago, where the morale is at almost an all-time low. And that's the thing that, so it's in some ways it's kind of manufactured hype among the media, and a lot of the fans will kind of will hear that and think, okay, that's the gospel truth. The reality is that it does need to be more grounded. There's a long way to go. The two things that are lacking in this U.S. team, which has been lacking for quite a long time, one, they have the potential, which is the creativity. So you have the Gio Reynos, the Weston McKennies, and other players that could actually develop and be creators and create opportunities. But the biggest thing that's missing to me, Kartik, is the U.S. still is missing a striker. To me, watching this match, I'm watching Kiefer Moore for Wales. I mean, the tall, 6'5" forward, and I'm like, if he played for the United States, he'd be perfect for that in terms of whether it's long balls or just a big man, but an opportunity to score a lot of goals. And I think that's what the U.S. is missing. And without that, without a really top level striker, which has been missing for a long time, they're going to have a difficult time in World Cup tournaments in the future.
Yeah, and I think the other issue with the U.S. that I have is I still think I see a lot of individual errors, right? These mistakes that are caused by bad decision-making on the ball that a guy like Tyler Adams doesn't make it. Tyler Adams, by the way, one player I will rave about is him because I think he's one of the smartest, the headiest players I've ever seen play for the U.S. He reads the game better than just about any American player I can say in the last 30 years. So I give him a lot of credit. But there are other guys that still get caught on the ball in bad situations, play the wrong pass. They're between two minds. And these are the kind of mental errors I see time and again from American players. So saw it again today. Saw a fair amount of that, and that worries me because what we've seen about the U.S. in this bad run the last few years, when the U.S. went from being a really well organized, well drilled team that maximized results 10 years ago to where they are now, is the number of individual mistakes, guys getting caught on the ball, guys playing the wrong pass at the wrong moment, making the wrong decision. And a lot of that is mental. And I don't think that's changed at all, if I'm going to be perfectly honest with you. And that, to me, you can have all the talent in the world. Until that mental part is right, you're still going to struggle.
Absolutely. All right, let's move on to TV streaming news, Kartik.
Yeah, and I'll kick it off talking about following this past Wednesday's action in the Champions League on Univision through match day three. We've had three match days. Matches are currently up 39% in terms of viewership over a year ago, delivering a combined 432,000 viewers across Unimas and Galavision over that period. Unimas is averaging 372,000 viewers, which is plus 35% 35% over a year ago through three match days, and obviously the rest remainder of those viewers are on Galavision. Some highlights of this: the current group stage ranks as the second highest ever, trailing only the 2018 group stage on the Univision networks. Juventus Barcelona, which was on Unimas, was the number one rated UEFA Champions League group stage ever in this country, irrespective of language, so in English or Spanish. And Real Madrid Inter on Unimas ranks as the third best UEFA Champions League group stage match ever, regardless of language. And the Juventus Barcelona match, I think we talked about this last week, the rating was blew I think everybody's mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a few things here too. I think Univision, TUDN/A, have done a fantastic job at consistency. Consistently, you know that they're going to have the games, you know it's going to be on usually Unimas or Galavision, sometimes Univision for some of the bigger games. That's the first thing. The second thing is, I think, accessibility and having these games be available over the air versus in the past, a couple of years ago, Turner and some of their games on TNT, but then most of the games on streaming. And of course, now with CBS, with very few of those games available on television, the vast majority, actually all of them, available on streaming. And then the third thing, I think it's in many ways, Kartik, when you think about it, look back to maybe like, say, 5 or 6 years ago, and I don't think any of us could have imagined that Univision would be leading the pack in terms of the most viewership for Champions League games, which was up until several years ago, really kind of an English language property. A Spanish language property wasn't much of a factor. So I think all in all, I think Univision and TUDN/A definitely doing well and taking advantage too of CBS not having many games on television.
I think they've also benefited, believe it or not, from the emphasis that that their rival, their great rival Telemundo, I think, has placed on the Premier League, because that has oriented Spanish language dominant fans to a league in Europe and watching it over the air. And obviously, yeah. TUDN/A, or the forerunner of TUDN/A, Univision Deportes Network, showed a fair amount of Bundesliga and Liga at one point also. So they've kind of gradually, I think there's been a shift to where at one time Spanish language networks and Spanish language dominant audiences were exposed in that language simply to and they give Gol TV some credit for this going back in their bilingual approach also. But I think recently, especially, you've seen Telemundo and Univision step up with European leagues. And that has been an interesting gateway for people to watch in Spanish. And look, I think a lot of English language fans are watching Univision. And it's also the presentation is very good. Now, maybe CBS is more of a rival than Turner was. But I think this is still spillover from how bad Turner was at covering Champions League, that more and more English language dominant fans got accustomed to watching Univision. And then obviously you have the issue of CBS having so much behind the paywall.
Yeah, and it's also a benefactor of the more and more Latinos playing in the UEFA Champions League, whether it's Raul Jimenez at Wolves and et cetera, et cetera. The next news item, speaking of CBS, CBS All Access and Showtime are now at a combined 17.9 million subscribers. And compared to a year ago, the number of subscribers is up 72%. So even though we just talked about TUDN/A and Univision doing so well on the television side, CBS All Access, I'm sure a significant portion of those numbers have come from the soccer world in terms of you want to watch all the Champions League games, all the Europa League games, post-match, pre-match, halftime analysis with Jimmy Carragher and you name it, Rafa Honigstein. CBS All Access has done a great job at that. So their numbers are way, way up. Now, Kartik, speaking of streaming, this is an interesting one because I think this is a story that you followed in the past, as I have done, and you've had experience dealing with this. But I'll let you cue it up.
Yeah, so Mike Cujo, which is a popular streaming service where you can, which streams lots of leagues, and quite honestly, you can set up to stream your independent club or stream a league yourself, which we've done at Himmershey FC, where I'm on the board, has been acquired by 11 Sports, which gives, I think, more of a window to potentially these lower division leagues. 11 is going to launch their own global streaming service as part of this, and should mention that I always had the sense, Chris, now it's easy to say in hindsight, but always had the sense my Cujo was being set up to be sold and acquired. Mm-hmm. That was the goal behind the project. I always felt that in the back of my mind, and that's happened now. So now a bigger potential global platform with 11 Sports, and then launching their own streaming service, which will put them in direct competition with everybody, basically. So that's another kind of well-funded player in the streaming side covering soccer.
Yeah, this one for me is more about 11 Sports wanting to have that global streaming service, and rather than trying to build that streaming service themselves, which would be very expensive and would require a ton of technical experience and development, etc., is that they've gone ahead and said, let's go ahead and buy it rather than build it. And acquiring My Cujo, which now they have the platform to go ahead and maybe reskin that and put have it as 11 Sports, and then launch that as a global streaming service where that no matter where you are, you could subscribe to watching some 11 Sports' content. In the US, just as one example, 11 Sports has the rights to the K-League, the Korean League, as well as in the past, they've had rights to the Belgian League. And they have games now and again from other niche leagues, but this gives them an opportunity to go ahead and perhaps acquire more rights in the near future. Moving on to TV ratings, Kartik, a couple of big numbers here to share. And Chelsea against Sheffield United on NBC on Saturday at the same time as De Clasica on ESPN+. We will not know what that ESPN+ number was, just because they're not sharing that streaming numbers. But Chelsea's Sheffield United, 843,000 viewers on NBC. Pretty impressive number, given that there was the De Clasica at the same time. And then as far as MLS, last weekend was the decision day on Sunday, with Eastern Conference games starting at 3:30, and then the Western Conference games, I think by the time they kicked off, it was about 7 p.m. The Western Conference game on television, national television, was LAFC against Portland on FS1. That one had 121,000 viewers, so about the same as what they normally get. And then on ABC and ESPN Deportes combined, that 3:30 game, which was Philadelphia against New England Revolution, 397,000 viewers. So that one's actually a pretty decent number there for ABC and MLS. Listener mailbag. We've got a bunch this week, and one really long one that we've saved for this week, which we'll get to in a minute. But first up is Guam94. And Guam94 says, I discovered your podcast on Pandora and now listen to it weekly on Amazon Music. I recently watched We Are LAFC on ESPN Plus and would love to hear your opinions on Bob Bradley's time at Swansea. I know that's an old topic, but I'd love to know the gaffer's opinion, especially since he's a supporter. Keep up the great work. So speaking of Wales against USA, the game that was played at Liberty Stadium, Swansea's home. Yeah, if we go back in time, I was supportive of the hiring of Bob Bradley. I thought that in terms of his coaching ability and his knowledge, but he was really the victim of just poor timing. He was brought in, I think it was after the transfer window, so it was like late September, maybe early October, and was let go before the next transfer window. So he had no opportunity to go ahead and bring in some players that that could change the team around. He was stuck with the players he had. And the players he had were decent, but definitely morale was low and needed a confidence boost. He did get a few wins, but ultimately, I think to me, it came down more so to individual player mistakes, talking about the US and what Kartik mentioned, which was really the main reason that eventually he got fired. And I think the actual opportunity that Bob Bradley had was razor thin, or paper thin. I think there was a lot of pressure from the media, a lot of pressure from fans, just because he was American. And if he was English or Spanish or German or French, he probably would have been given some more time. But Swansea really were in a tough situation where they had to pull the trigger, and Bob Bradley got fired. They brought in, I think, Paul Clemens, I think it was. And Paul eventually, by the skin of his teeth, managed to keep the team up that season, but they eventually got relegated. So I'm a big supporter of his time there. I just think that in terms of the way the perception among an average soccer fan is that Bob Bradley was a disaster. Bob Bradley was awful. He didn't know how to manage. The reality is that he did well. And actually, a couple of the players that he brought in that he had playing in the team, giving them opportunities, have gone on to much greater and bigger things after Bob Bradley got fired. So in hindsight, I think actually he did a decent job with what he had. I would have loved to have seen him at least get a transfer window in the January to bring in some players, some fresh blood, and give him a few more months. And I think ultimately he would have probably kept them up. I mean, who knows? But that those are my thoughts on that one. All right, Kartik, are you ready for this one? So this is a long one, but it's a good one. So it's from Dave Roberts. He says, the point of this feedback is not to raise your ire, but I know it's going to happen. So I apologize in advance to both of you, especially to you, Kartik, because I like you a little more than half as much as you deserve. But here goes. I do forthwith, wholeheartedly, enthusiastically, and with every single fiber of my soccer-loving being, completely, totally, and utterly support the plans for a European Premier League. That said, I don't think it goes far enough. I also support any future plan to create a pan-European second division as well. Why do I think this? Because there's too much money in the game in the domestic leagues. Not only in England, but across the board in every league, the big teams have too much money, are spending too much money, and have created an unsustainable system that is destroying the game at the local level. They have created a wall of cash made bricks that basically make it impossible for smaller community-centric teams to compete at the highest levels. These teams are guilty of what the Euro snobs are accusing MLS of doing in the US. Sorry, but it's true. Teams in England are owned by royal families, Russian mobsters, and energy drink companies. Sure, in Germany there's the 50+1 rule, but we've seen that to be twisted and manipulated. And obviously some fans love it and don't care. I don't recall if it was either Kartik or Chris who mentioned that this plan was to compete with the NFL. Well, good. That league needs some competition. So let's get rid of those teams. The way the game is right now, the fans and the players are teetering on burnout. There's too much soccer. Owners, sponsors, and broadcasters are treating athletes like pawns designed solely for their entertainment and profit. They forget that they are human beings with emotions, feelings, and families. Some have argued that a pan-European Super League will kill the game. To that I say, balderdash. Instead, it will make the game more fun and competitive again. Many of these teams are treating the domestic competitions like mere friendlies to prepare for the European competitions. Their involvement in domestic leagues becoming mere formalities, and I don't think it's necessary for their continued involvement. It's not fair to the players nor to the fans. I know my opinion is an outlier, and many people like Kartik will disagree with me on the grounds of tradition. Well, tradition is a good song in Fiddler on the Roof, a musical that I'd urge you to rewatch to be reminded of its theme. Times change. Thanks for letting me rant. All right, Kartik, there's a lot to take in there. Overall, agree or disagree on this one?
I actually think he might be making some really good points, because that has become kind of I don't want to say a default view, but a popular view in the last couple weeks as people have processed this, which was at first outrage, and then it gradually gave way to, you know what, let's let them go, because then we'll get our game, our sport back. And there is part of me, I have to admit, that has now become kind of torn about this, thinking, you know, yeah, it would be great to have a competitive domestic leagues again. You know, if these top six clubs in England were all tossed out and ended up in this Super League, we would have a competitive product every season, right? So now, the question is, would there be enough TV money to sustain those domestic leagues? Since the model, and Ian Plenderleith had a really good article on this this week in Soccer America, if you subscribe to Soccer America, about how the entire model of these domestic leagues in Europe to be completely based around television money has now led to this sort of inevitable choice between a European Super League and protecting the traditions of the game. So yeah, check that out if you subscribe to Soccer America. I'm not always a huge fan of Plenderleith's writing, but I think he's pretty much really done a good job on this one. So I would I'm kind of torn now. I'm thinking, you know what, maybe it is for the best if these teams leave, or there's something that allows more competitiveness in domestic leagues if we're not going to have hard caps, etc. On spending. But I don't want hard caps either, because I think the hard caps then prevent the teams that need to be selling teams in order to sustain themselves financially from selling at top value their players. So my views might be evolving on this. I'm still against the concept, don't get me wrong. I think it just shows the selfishness and greed of these clubs. But maybe I'm at a point like Davis saying, you know what, good riddance. Get the heck out.
So I'm with Dave on a lot of these things, except there's one major fault in this. And he's talking about the European Super League or European Premier League, those teams leaving the Premier League or leaving Liga and leaving the Bundesliga. That's not what's not going to happen. I mean, what's supposed to happen is that these teams want to stay in their leagues. They want to stay in their domestic leagues, but then play in the European Super League. And in addition to that, in order to get basically have two bites of the pie.
Now, what's the point of having? Yeah.
Right. Because then, if anything, you're undermining the domestic leagues even more. So you have, say, Liverpool playing on a weekend game in the European Super League. They play midweek in some game against, I don't know, Burnley, and they field kind of a weaker team, or a second string team, just because they know in the following weekend they're playing Real Madrid.
And it won't matter where they finish in the league, right? Because they'll be in Europe permanently.
Right. So the only way for this to work would be for those teams to leave those domestic leagues and then to go into a European Super League. But then the European Super League, what was going to be, 16 teams, I think it is, would get a little bit boring after a while, because it's going to be the same teams over and over again. Very unlikely to have promotion and relegation. There's probably an opportunity to go ahead and apply to be added, but it's unlikely. So at first, perhaps, it'd be exciting having all these teams play, but maybe after the second season, it gets a little bit boring, and by the third season, it's very predictable. My biggest concern with all of this is who's driving it. Who's the one that's making the decisions to form whatever it turns into? And I have no faith in the clubs in that top 16 or 18 that's going to be in the European Super League, that they're going to have the best interest and they're going to have of viewers, and they're going to make the right decisions. I think they're going to basically go ahead and make it so that they can make as much money as possible, and include some competitiveness in there, but also a lot of protectionism. So ultimately, I like the concept, but I don't like them being in the same domestic leagues. So I don't think it's gonna work. I think if anything, it's just leverage to try to push both the Premier League and UEFA and FIFA in many ways to get more power, to get more revenue opportunities. And although I would like to see it happen sometimes, I don't think it's going to happen. I think it's just basically, I think it's just them trying to get more power, trying to manipulate people. All right, let's move on. RQJ says, I've been a fan since, well, forever. VAR adds nothing to the game. The tradition always has been some you win, some you lose, but it tends to equal out. Dump this horrible experiment, which is ruining the beautiful game. And I've got a few more ones about VAR here too. Leo says, VAR is the best invention of football history. The referee used to make mistakes that 9 times out of 10 served the big team. Now they can only try to do it as well, but everyone can see that they are either completely ill-suited for the job or just immoral human trash. Don Dickerson says, VAR, we love to hate it. If VAR wasn't used, we would be asking why easy fouls inside the box aren't being called. I'd much rather it being the blatant calls being overturned. If the VAR official can't come to a conclusion within, say, 30 seconds, then the call should stand. That would free up the need for the ref to go under the hood, to look at the monitor, if you will, to get a second look himself. I never want to see offsides by millimeters ever again. And then just a couple more VAR ones. This is from TK. It's funny that VAR was mentioned back-to-back on the last podcast with gambling. A country like Italy actually needed it. Strikers are being barely touched and going down this year. Crazy. Roberto says, I agree that one of the positive points with Major League Soccer is that their VAR has generally been useful. That is because they use the pitch-side monitor a lot more. This past weekend, there were some bad calls, but the teams that suffered got their revenge. San Jose against LAFC and Orlando against Columbus played much of a game with 10 men after very shaky calls. Both teams ended up winning their games. I agree with Leo about in the past, referees' calls favored the big teams. This year, like the pod said, the divers are mostly on those big teams and often get the penalties called. I wish there were more calls against the fakers. So, Kartik, before we move on to the next news item, let me save it for a minute. I was going to talk about Peacock, but let me save that for a second. Next up is RJ Hawkins. RJ says, Turner bailing on the Champions League was surprising to me. Can you recall a media company essentially giving up on rights early in the past? And also, with a blank slate, what do you think a full year of Champions League and Europa League looks like with CBS over the air integrated into the plan? Would CBS preempt shows like The Young and the Restless and Judge Judy for midweek games? Do those types of shows get good ratings? So let me answer the soap operas. Yeah, those get huge ratings. And I think it's unlikely that CBS is going to broadcast those games midweek. If anything, if CBS is going to broadcast some of these games over the air, it's going to be the weekend game. So it'll be your final and maybe a semi-final if it's ever on a weekend. But yeah, it's going to be I don't think it's going to be that many games on television. I think still it's going to be everything's on streaming anyway, no matter what. But I think with the success that CBS All Access has had, I don't think they're going to put many games on television.
Yeah, I agree. I think also in terms of backing out of rights early, I want to mention the Open Championship when ESPN had the rights, NBC gained it 2 years in advance, much like this situation with CBS gaining the UEFA rights 2 years in advance. And much like Turner did, ESPN opted out of the last year and NBC inherited the last year of the contract and then and now continues to broadcast the Open Championship. I don't think there'll be many games on television at all. I do think if you see some sort of change in the television windows, because they've done this at times with previous contracts, remember UEFA, where they've changed the timing of matches, maybe you'll see a match, or you might even see a match when we have if we continue to change our clocks and Europe continues to change their clocks, that's all in doubt. But there's some times where there will be Champions League matches that kick off at 4 p.m. Eastern, which would be after the soap operas run.
Yeah.
Right. That they might show one of those matches.
Yeah, excellent point there. JP says, Kartik, sounds like you've been involved with fantasy for at least a few years. In the short term it does make you more knowledgeable about players and leagues, but in the long run it bastardizes how you enjoy the sport. I've gone cold turkey on fantasy for NFL the last couple of years and it's great. No longer follow games I would have no interest in other than a certain player's performance. For the games I do watch, I'm not obsessing about stats, just enjoy the game and competition. Also realized the only reason I was still following baseball was fantasy and quit that too. Haven't missed baseball one bit. Kartik, and then the last point here is about NBCSN And also, we'll talk about Peacock in a minute. But Tim Keane says, what happened to NBCSN last Saturday morning? Only Rebecca Lowe and Tim Howard. I thought Tim Howard was a little out of his depth doing all the analysis. He seemed to stumble and stutter a lot. Was that because he was thrown in the deep end at the last moment? I did not hear any explanation as to why there was a lack of on-air personalities. And his beard is getting out of control. He's beginning to look like Rasputin. Yeah, that was another thing. I mean, it was actually Robbie Musto. So Robbie Musto came on, I think, for the second game. He wasn't there for the early game on Saturday. And who knows? Maybe he had a doctor's appointment. Maybe he had something going on, and or maybe it was traffic. Or who knows? But he wasn't there, and it was just Rebecca and Tim for one of those early broadcasts on Saturday. But Robbie Musto was there a little bit later. So things happen, but it does underline, Kartik, I think, how thin that talent is, right? We've seen Rebecca Lowe not on the air on some late Sunday games post-match because she has to catch a plane. And the other guys are Liam McHugh and Ahmed Farid are busy. And that's about it. They don't have, in many ways, though, I'm surprised that they're not utilizing Sky Sports as much as they could, because that could be an opportunity to kind of bring them in a little bit, or to use some of their coverage. They haven't done that thus far.
Yeah, that's actually the surprising part, right? Because, I mean, it's pretty clear that they're in some sort of cost-cutting mode in terms of talent. But that's a really good point. And we've seen the sidekicks come and go, right? You know, obviously, Musto was there part of the time last weekend, wasn't there all the time. It seems like Howard is working more than Earl or Musto. And I just think the level of the entire presentation has dropped off. I mean, it's funny, Chris, when you and I started saying this a while ago, we got a lot of blowback. Now, more and more people privately are telling me, yeah, you know, you were probably right. They never did replace Steve Bauer. They really haven't adequately replaced Kyle Martino. You know, they really haven't done the job with the kind of the bumper programming that they used to do. They haven't replaced Neil Ashton. They haven't gotten another person who can report news on their program. So, I don't know. I'm just very frustrated by it.
It's if we go back in the time machine to 2013, we have to remember too that Gary Lineker was part of NBC's broadcast. That he would be obviously in London or in the UK doing some of the coverage of some of the games. Mark Clattenburg.
Or he'd have a pitch side desk.
Right, exactly, for some of the big matches in the studio.
Yeah.
Mark Clattenburg, I mean, as a referee analyst, we haven't seen him in probably about a year, maybe even longer than that. Danny Higginbotham was brought in a few times to kind of...
Now we see him on CBS.
Right, on CBS Sports HQ. So these people are available, and especially with Zoom and even teleconferencing, it's probably easier than ever to go ahead and do a video conference with some of these guys. Obviously, they prefer the in-studio, which limits them in many ways, but it is what it is, Kartik. I mean,
they had Phil Neville involved in the presentation of the Tottenham. Remember when they did the thing with Pochettino? They had Phil Neville on site for that. Exclusively for NBC. It wasn't a world feed thing.
Yeah, I think we forget after a while too. But even like some of the stand-ups interviews they've had pre-match, it's been a long time since we've had them interview some of the commentators. Like Rebecca Lowe would be interviewing Peter Drury about the upcoming game on a Sunday, or Martin Tyler and getting pitch side. Usually it'd be Martin Tyler and Danny Higginbotham on a Monday, talking about that coming game and some of the storylines, and we haven't gotten that in a long, long time.
Yeah, so, and the Monday program was really kind of useful, because even after Steve Bauer reduced his commitment to NBC and became a much more important part of what the BBC was doing with Match of the Day, they would still bring him in on Monday, and because he'd been in the Match of the Day studio or doing whatever for the BBC, he had some insights in that Monday a pregame show, and oftentimes that wasn't Rebecca Lowe hosting. It has been Ahmed Farid for a few years now, or Liam McHugh. But Bauer would add to that presentation. And then in terms of not replacing Neil Ashton, I think that's a huge thing, because I know everybody can like Google things and read whichever publication they prefer, the Telegraph or the Guardian or Times, to get news. But there's still, I think, a value if you're going to cover a league and have bumper programming around the matches, to having a reporter who has some insight and can not only break news or talk about rumors, but then analyze what that means.
Right, and, given the context.
Yeah, and give the context to that. And Neil Ashton wasn't the only guy in the business. Okay, I know he left, and now he's advising Ed Woodward, and he's got his own comm shop. But there are lots of other guys, whether it's John Cross or whoever, they could hook up. Matt Law, I could go on and on, right? Yeah. Henry Winter, et cetera, that they could hook up via remote from London. I mean, ESPN FC, again, I know people think I'm maybe a little too obsessive about that program, but Darren Thomas has a host of people coming on the show from London, whether it's Julian Lorenz or Gab Marcotti or Don Hutchinson or whoever. They don't have to be in Connecticut. And obviously they've gone to a more remote setup since COVID anyway. But I don't know why NBC now Ashton left in January, right? So it's been 11 months. They haven't done anything about it.
Yeah, I think it has to be cost-cutting. I mean, because we've seen from CBS Sports all the talent that they've hired, and almost every single show that they do, there's new talent that comes on board, whether it's Gus Poyet or whoever it may be, and it's a whole host of new characters. So we've seen how it can be done, even on a short-term contract or just a kind of a freelance contract, having this talent involved in analyzing the game and adding more depth, making it more interesting. And it really is. I mean, CBS, I mean, it just as one example, is really, really making NBC Sports look inadequate.
That's a good name, actually. I was thinking about this while we were talking about it. Why doesn't NBC hire someone who's a Premier League manager? Gus Poyet. Just bring him in, you know, hook him up from London. Obviously, he's not going to come to Connecticut. Hook him up for a segment a week or every couple of weeks. I mean, yeah. That's another perspective that could be useful.
Yeah.
But obviously, CBS has beat them to him. So,
but that's the thing, though, too. NBC has Sky Sports as a sister company. You would think that maybe they go to Kelly Cates and say, hey, Kelly, are you available to give some analysis about Liverpool? Or, you mean, there's definitely a lot of talent at Sky Sports, some good, some bad, some indifferent, that they could definitely tap into and incorporate that more into their broadcast to kind of fill in those gaps. They haven't done that thus far. Karthik, about Peacock, I do want to address it, because this might be something that other listeners may have similar issues with. The first point you mentioned in that first segment is talking about trying to go ahead and cast or mirror games to your television using, like, say, an iPad or a phone. You have an Apple TV, so why aren't you doing it on Apple TV? Just out of curiosity.
Yeah, because the stream wasn't good because there was some bandwidth issue. So
okay.
So from the app on Apple TV, there was some kind of limitation in bandwidth. I think it was because, although I have to say, it was a Peacock thing, because come to think of it, when I got frustrated and said, and you know, this was Liverpool Man City, it wasn't a match I wanted to miss. Okay, there's a Bundesliga match on, and then they had Juventus was playing, although the Juventus game had been earlier, but they not the Lazio Juventus match, but there was a Serie A match on. I'll try ESPN, and the ESPN Plus feed was fine, so it was a Peacock error. And then I tried the Peacock also on the LG app, and I had a similar streaming issue. Now the matches were streaming. I don't want to say this was like the previous week or whenever the Aston Villa Leeds match was, when it gave me an error. Peacock can't load now. It was loading. It just wasn't. It was more of it was a standard definition.
Right, quality. Feed. Right.
Yeah, it was a quality thing. Which again, we were in the middle of a tropical storm. We were. If you follow the news, we've had probably our worst flooding in decades here in South Florida. So it may not totally be on them, and it may be just be that ESPN happened to work better. So that's what happened there. So then I tried to mirror it, and I couldn't mirror it. Now that having been said, the picture was perfect on both the iPhone and then the iPad. So there was no bandwidth restriction for Peacock on either of those devices. I just didn't feel like sitting and watching the game on my iPad.
Yeah, and it could be a Wi-Fi issue too, where, you mean, AT&T Viewverse, the actual quality of that signal, I mean, it's the strength of that connection is not that great. I haven't had any issues, which is why I wanted to bring it up. But the second thing is that definitely, if you haven't done so thus far, and the same for listeners too, if you guys are experiencing issues, is that they do have a Twitter account, which is Peacock TV Care, and you can go ahead and DM them, and they will definitely, their tech support will help you out as much as they can to try to troubleshoot or problem solve issues. So I would encourage anyone that does have issues with that, check it out, because that could actually maybe something that they can fix. Maybe it's a setting, and maybe it's ESPN Plus handles lower bandwidth better as far as the way that they process that, perhaps. So maybe it's a setting, but check that out. So it's Twitter, but it's Peacock TV Care, C-A-R-E, and then also they have a Peacock help and support on their website. And I think there's a contact us form there that you can fill out, and then hopefully they can resolve it. Because the reality, Kartik, I mean, is unfortunately for many of us, I mean, is that Peacock is here to stay. And we've seen from the Man City Liverpool game, I mean, at this point, it seems to be now, unless it's on a Saturday 12:30 Eastern time kickoff on NBC, all the big games are on Peacock. And I think for next season, the final season of NBC's deal, we're likely to see even more big games on Peacock. And who knows, maybe the last season it could be Peacock TV has everything except for your NBC game on Saturdays at 12:30. Anything can happen. All right, Kartik. So listeners, if you do have any questions for us, any feedback, any questions about streaming or watching games on television, any feedback on anything we've discussed thus far or some ideas for future topics, let us know. We want you to have your say. You can always reach us via email through web at worldsoccertalk.com, as well as facebook.com/worldsoccertalk, and on Twitter at worldsoccertalk. Plus, of course, you can always post your comments on worldsoccertalk.com. Kartik, before we go, where can listeners find you to get updates on everything from politics to Florida history to soccer and weather and storm reports and much more?
Yeah, let's hope the storm reports stop now. I mean,
it's the middle of November.
It mid-November, we'd still be not only dealing with it, but ETA was really, really bad for the state of Florida. It's KKFLA 737.
All right, so we've got a lot to look forward to this weekend. Of course, we've got CONMEBOL World Cup qualifiers. We've got the U.S. plays again on Monday, as I mentioned, against Panama in a friendly that's going to be played in Austria, of all places. And then over the weekend, too, we've also got UEFA Nations League and Africa Cup of Nations. I watched a great game this week, which was Ghana against Sudan. So those games are on beIN Sports television. But we have the whole schedule for all the games during the international break at worldsoccertalk.com. So check that out. And Kartik, heading into another weekend of soccer from around the world, what are you going to do and what should the listeners do?
Enjoy your football.